Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Terenda White, an assistant professor and sociologist of education in the School of Education at the University of Colorado Boulder. Dr. White's current research focuses on market-based education reforms in urban communities and its cultural and pedagogical impact on teacher dispositions, teacher professional autonomy and identity, and the development of inclusive classroom practices. She's the co-author of several peer-reviewed publications and the co-author of the book entitled 21st Century Jim Crow Schools, The Impact of Charters on Public Education. Dr. White, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with one of your recent publications entitled Teacher Dissent in Neoliberal Times, Counterpublics and Alternative Publics in Teacher Activism. What motivated you to investigate this topic?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have colleagues who were exploring the opt-out movement, actually, which is a movement around with parents around opting out of testing and sort of these sort of really public refusals of what districts and state departments of education were sort of asking of parents and students around testing. And there was just a themed writing opportunity to think about other kinds of refusals. And teachers are a part of how I thought about dissent, about and what dimensions of educational sort of policies have teachers really taken a stand against. And maybe we don't call it opting out, but we do think about it as refusals or dissents in light of policy moments in the past 10 or 15 years. And so the teacher strikes, of course, really stood out to me as one sort of public form of dissent. The strikes, you know, are definitely formal work stoppages and ways for teachers to sort of say, this is not enough. We want these sort of sets of demands either from their districts or state leaders. But this particular piece was also philosophical. It was my first time sort of really chewing on other forms of dissent that I think are just as influential in the era that we're in, including sort of these private withdrawals or folks, teachers, who think of themselves very differently than our traditional maybe district teachers or teachers who might be a part of a union and organize more formally to contest different aspects of their work. And so thinking about dissent in a neoliberal or a sort of market-driven era where it's a private form of dissent and private in multiple ways, private in terms of individuals thinking less of themselves as a part of a collective and as individual worker who might make decisions that are rooted in sort of a more individualized focus of their work, and also private in terms of actually thinking about the private sector as a way to opt out of more traditional public forms of teacher professionalism and school organization. So that's a long answer to say it was a moment to think about refusal and a moment to think about dissent and to think about it in terms of how teachers have participated in dissent in different ways that I think need to be explored and what I tried to explore in this particular article.
As you think about how teachers push back against neoliberal reforms, how do you conceptualize neoliberalism? And what policies would you say have emerged from this ideology that directly affect teachers?
So that's a great question. We tend to use that word a lot without defining it. And so I tend to sort of, I read a lot of David Harvey's work, which is a book that I'll probably recommend at the end of this, A Brief History of Neoliberalism. But it's basically a moment where, and it's no longer a moment, I would call it an era, where we really do believe in, or people have attempted to, particularly reformers and leaders, to really narrow down the sort of government or public quote-unquote bureaucracies, and to really rely on and outsource a lot of services to the private sector, to private management, nonprofit, for profit. But this idea that government is too big, we need to really shrink it down, austerity is a part of that. And that even with that in place, also this sort of embracing of school choice, particularly school choice, competition, as a way to improve the functioning of systems and organizations and bureaucracies, and that if you invite competition and choice, that would improve and make more efficient our public institutions. So neoliberalism is this idea of sort of freeing up liberties, individual liberties, with shrinking central governance in many ways, and sort of decentralizing and deregulating a number of public institutions.
So you focus on two teacher groups, the Chicago Teachers Union and the organization Teach for America. Why did you decide to focus on these two groups?
So I had already started studying the Chicago Teachers Union as, I think, a new and important era in teacher organizing and teacher activism and unionism, actually. I think that they have been pivotal in linking teacher grievances, and that's really oversimplifying, but teacher concerns with student and learning concerns, and connecting the dots between what some would call teacher working conditions and student learning conditions, and that the kinds of policies that were adversely affecting teachers are also adversely affecting students, and that the fate of schools and public schools in particular requires more intentional alliance building between parents, communities, and teachers. And so I had already started looking at, you know, even since their work in 2012, when they went on strike in Chicago, and it was considered one of the most popular strikes, you know, parent support, community support, which I had known enough about the history of tensions between teachers and communities of color in particular. Like, you know, I had looked at and studied what had happened in Brownsville and New York and in other places. I knew that CTU had entered an important era of what some are calling now community-based unionism or social justice unionism, being intentional about creating a shared understanding and a shared struggle with communities and teachers, which I think is very powerful. And I thought, well, you know, they are sort of demonstrating important forms of refusal, not just in strikes, but sort of strikes that are about public education and about the fate of public education, and that have deep alliances and relationships. And what I was thinking, or calling it like new publics, they formed publics that are not just teachers, or what some would call, you know, middle-class white teachers who are pushing against or you know, going on strike for more insular issues. They had created a public that I thought was more intertwined with community folk, residents, parents, and anyone who cared about community control of public institutions. So, and then I thought, well, what rivals, you know, as a teacher organization that's really creating and doing new things, I couldn't ignore Teach for America, because I had also written about Teach for America. I've also been a part of Teach for America, and I've also been a part of the critical sort of analysis and examination of how TFA has evolved in the past 30 years. So, but they were so different from CTU that it really just became clear that they were, you know, opposites of one another or foils of one another. You know, one group that was really connecting to the publicness of education and the publicness of dissent, and really creating coalitions to push for more resources that would affect and improve education for everybody, including teachers and students. And I thought TFA represented a different form of dissent in terms of embracing and encouraging its recruits and its members to participate in schools that are not rooted in publicness or democratic control of public institutions, and really embracing a more market-based, private-oriented, whether it's the sort of the big charter chains, placing so many recruits in those kinds of schools, and not even really taking a strong stance during strikes, I thought was really interesting. This sort of creating a feigning a neutral stance when there really is no such thing as neutrality here, to not sort of think about participating in these moments where teachers are demanding more for the profession and for their longevity, to not have a clear stance from TFA during those moments, I thought was a political stance. So anyway, so I just realized that they, in many ways, are different kinds of, they represent organizationally different forms of teacher activism and teacher dissent. And that's where it just went down that hole of thinking about, well, what does this mean in terms of either strengthening or weakening the democratic nature of public schools, and how teachers have built divergent audiences and associations and quote unquote publics that they speak to, that they marshal and leverage in different ways that can create different ideas about activism.
So you describe these groups as publics, and in your article you say teacher publics, and more specifically you use two terms, so counter publics and alternative publics. What do you mean by these terms, and how do you arrive at making these distinctions?
So this is where I was informed by work already written by Nancy Fraser had already written about counter publics. But this idea that there is a space outside of the quote unquote market and the like government or the state. So there are these formal structures, but there is like citizens and the public and like, you know, everyday people trying to make sense of the world that they're in, and that the public needs to be robustly engaged and informed to push back, control, shape, influence the state and enterprise or the private sector. And so typically we think of publics as like, you know, parents, residents, like people. And I kept thinking our teachers are a part of the public because, you know, they are state, you know, they do represent the state, you know, they are hired and licensed by state entities. But they are also engaging in their communities and in other teacher groups that aren't always formally a part of any sort of, you know, no one's requiring them to create reading groups, right? Like, you know, CTU does like reading groups that inform both parents, teachers, everyday folk about like, what is privatization? What is neoliberalism? What is school closure? Where did this come from? And so and vice versa with TFA. I mean, they have magazines, they have podcasts, they have, you know, that's not tied to any, you know, job. That's not a job that's being compelled on their part, you know, by the state or by the district. They are building groups, audiences, associations that are a part of the public sphere, because those folks then also shape ideas, opinions about education or about educational policy. And so I think they are both very active in organizing spaces for people to debate about things or to learn, to discuss, to dialogue. And, you know, if you're not tied to either one of them, it might sound like I'm, you know, overselling this, but it's actually true. Like TFA has a very robust set of networks and forums and magazines. I actually still get their magazines or podcasts. And if you are sort of a part of this long, almost like 30 years now of core members, alumni, you are a part of that type of public where it's those core members are in the public sphere, especially, you know, when they many of whom leave teaching and they are in different kinds of positions and they play different roles in our society, but they connect, they're still connected in a way that creates this public. But CTU for me is also what I think what Nancy Fraser would call a counter public. And for counter, it is countering a sort of bourgeois public, a more privileged public, a more dominant public, a public that tends to be sort of the constitution and makeup of that, of what we think of as the public is usually white folk, middle-class folk, affluent folk, people who whose voices are often heard and are often very vocal. A counter public is intentionally trying to tap into those that are usually marginalized, usually on the periphery, that are submerged, whose voices are not often heard. And I think the way CTU goes about connecting to and educating parents in that city, who are in public schools, who often are Black folk, working class folk, and I think the kind of audiences and the kind of education and the kind of awareness building campaigns that they do engages that counter public. They, not a bourgeois public, not an already privileged public, but parents who often don't feel, you know, they feel oftentimes that school policies are happening to them, but not with them, not for them, not by them. And so I sort of think of them as a counter public in that sense. And TFA, I at first I was thinking of, are they anti-public? And I actually had written several manuscripts where it was like a counter public and here's the anti-public. But that felt, you know, really, really harsh. And I don't, you know, I don't want, you know, a title to make people not even engage or read. But I think it was quote unquote safer to say, and in many ways, TFA is an alternative public in the sense that they think about, quote unquote, improving public education through alternative associations. So I think their listeners, their audiences, their people, their like the folks that they build with to create reform or to create ideas about how to improve public schools via reform, is more amenable to folks outside the public sphere, folks in the private sphere, fundraising, nonprofits, philanthropists, corporate foundations. And to me, that's, some would say, well, isn't that anti-public? That's not like you're not really engaging and strengthening the publicness of education. But at the very least, it is definitely an alternative way in which they think or strategize to improve public schools is to leverage partnerships with folks beyond the public and largely in the business sector, private sector, nonprofit sector. So which group or strategy actually improves the democratic purposes of public education, which is to inform the public about and to improve their capacity actually to hold accountable, to weigh in, to challenge more powerful groups and entities, to sort of reclaim schools as theirs and to sort of build that capacity. And I think and I land on the side of CTU as a counter public that actually really improves the capacity of parents and everyday folk, working folk, to weigh in and sort of say, why did my school close? You know, where are we in creating these ideas of choice, and where are we in parents and even in teachers? Where are we in these grand schemes to remake public schools? Are our voices there? And if they are ostensibly about equity, why does it feel so unequal and inequitable in terms of who loses jobs, who loses their neighborhood schools, who loses the kind of curriculum that they want? Empowerment does not leave you feeling that type of loss.
So I want to move to a second article that you recently published, entitled Chartering a Different Course, a Critical Policy Framework to Support Black Women in Marketized Cities and Schools. In it, you examine the pedagogical implications of race, gender, and power embedded in market-based reforms and how this shaped the experience of teachers who are Black women. Why, in your view, are Black women more likely to experience market-based reforms, and why is it especially important to examine the experience of Black women teachers?
I think that if you center the experiences of Black teachers, and the majority of whom are Black women, but we have black male teachers or male identified Black teachers who are also very important in our understanding of the contributions of Black educators. But Black women in particular have been the bulk of the Black teaching workforce. And I think their experiences also can inform us a lot about the racialized impact of our current policies. And if we know that their pedagogical contributions are very important, we have to think about the intersection of our policies with their pedagogies. And just the fact of so many Black teachers report involuntary turnover because of accountability-driven school closures and turnaround policies. We've actually seen declines in Black teachers in our major cities. And many of those Black teachers are Black women. And I just wanted to move them to the center in terms of how we organize to rethink the consequences of the current policies that have been implemented in terms of market-based reform, charter school expansions. Where are Black women, where are Black teachers, and how these policies land? And unfortunately, I think it's been too often a story of displacement. And even when they are recruited for the sake of diversity, it's really tied to very instrumentalist reasons to improve test score outcomes or whatnot. But they have a lot to contribute in terms of the climate and culture of schooling, discipline and ways of restructuring the climate in schools so that it is humanizing, culturally sustaining, asset-based. And I think we can no longer talk about those kinds of visions without thinking about the policies that have stripped the conditions to do the kinds of culturally sustaining anti-racist work that we know Black teachers can do. So this piece is really thinking about how do we charter and build in a critical policy framework that no longer undermines the pedagogical possibilities and contributions of Black women.
So you explained that you use a critical race policy framework. How did this help you when studying the experience of Black women teachers?
So critical policy analysis and critical policy writers have inspired me for a long time. And these are folks who take serious the issue of power and asymmetry of power. And they sort of think about what are the claims and the intentions of a policy, and how is it experienced? How is it enacted? How is it implemented? Who constructed it? And there's usually oftentimes a disconnect between the aims of a policy and its impact. And I had already sort of really loved sort of thinking critically about policy. Critical race policy helped me to think not just about power and asymmetries of power, but white power in particular, and really naming racism and race and anti-Black racism in particular as a legacy and even a present moment issue that we no longer need to or should hide the ball on. And so for me, it was just really honoring critical race theorists who have really shaped my thinking in that way, and critical policy folks who really think about policy in a critical way. And I actually think those people write in conversation with one another, actually. So together, that just sort of helped me think about really being sensitive to the experiences of Black teachers and Black women teachers using frameworks that center race and experience and that really question policy aims versus impact.
So you make a distinction between charter management organizations and standalone charter schools. Why was this an important distinction for you to make?
I think it's important to understand that the charter world is quite, you know, nuanced, actually. And you know, even when I was writing my dissertation in Harlem, New York, I could not ignore that some of the earliest charter schools in that community were community-based charter schools, standalone charter schools. They were all partnering with community-based organizations. They did not see themselves as a business or as a sort of, they weren't outside managers coming in to sort of create a test-centric, no-excuses type of education. They were a part of that community and had really saw the charter movement as an opportunity to create independent, culturally sensitive schools. That is not the story, unfortunately, for the past 30 or so years for the charter movement. We see a lot of large-scale sort of managerialist type of schools that believe in a no excuses policy that unfortunately can really lead to really harmful disciplinary practices. And so I think, it was my way of making sense of or giving a nod to the fact that the charter world has its dominant players and its folk who are in the shadows, but who are doing something quite different with their charter. So I think the more dominant groups that are a part of large scale management companies or whatnot, who employ very sort of cookie cutter approaches to teaching kids, I do think that they draw on market-based educational reforms. They really do see themselves in competition with district schools and are really thinking about they market themselves very intentionally and are thinking about brand. And so that to me is just very explicitly market driven, which is not the same as what some of the smaller standalone community-based charters, how they view and construct what they do in their schools.
So what did you find were the experience of Black women in marketized cities and schools?
So these are women that I had interviewed in different cities, mainly in New York City and in Boston. And these were teachers who had been recruited or who had circumstantially found themselves in various types of charter schools. Overwhelmingly, there was a sense that they were overworked, doing more with less security, less sort of autonomy, actually, which is the irony of all of it, is that this is a sector that is built on autonomy, but it's usually autonomy for leaders. That autonomy is not evenly distributed with the teachers. And so Black teachers felt that that was particularly problematic for the pedagogies that they had wanted and were prepared to do. And so to be in a place where you have less protection, less autonomy, but you were hoping to do more in this sort of new world that's deregulated and decentralized, that was particularly painful. And for these Black teachers, it was a matter of, do I stay and not do the kind of teaching that I think is best for my students, or do I leave and be a part of what we know is churn and turnover, unfortunately, that's higher in some of the charter schools. And so they were particularly caught up in that dilemma. But and so I just offer, what recommendations should we think about if we want to think about protecting the pedagogical excellence of many of our Black teachers, and particularly Black women? And that has to start with thinking about solidifying autonomy and even rethinking unionism. And this is where CTU comes back into play. Social movement unionism, community-based unionism, those are things that can protect not just teacher working conditions, but the learning conditions for students, particularly the pedagogies that we know we need to disrupt very racist and problematic deficit based practices. How can you as a teacher do that if you yourself are not protected in that particular school? So that's where I sort of develop these recommendations that have to take more seriously the conditions and the inequities in power that these new systems have created in light of a market vision.
Thank you, Dr. White. Next month, we'll be speaking with Jack Schneider and Jennifer Brookshire, hosts of the Have You Heard podcast and co-authors of the book A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, The Dismantling of Public Education and the Future of School. As always, thanks for listening. We hope that you're safe and healthy. And for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu. and follow NEPC on Twitter @NEPCTweet.